This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. We may have gone through the personal tax reform issues from the federal government. Now there's some other issues that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as it's officially called, might have on your retirement planning. And for that, we're turning to Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer. Greg, as always, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking.
Thanks, Chris. Thanks for having me on.
Well, tell us a little bit about why we should be concerned about the changes in the federal laws that have impacted the tax returns that we're going to be dealing with this coming tax year, the one we're in right now, and what it's going to mean for those of us who are planning for retirement.
So there's a couple of, actually several changes in it, and some of the most impactful things are the tax treatment. There's lower tax brackets right now. And the brackets have significantly increased, especially when you look at the single impact. The single tax preparer has always paid a lot in taxes, and there's been a lot of improvement for opportunity to do some effective planning. And the planning specifically entails possible ways to reduce the tax implications in the future based on doing some potential things today with your retirement accounts or how you're saving money and doing it all at a lower tax bracket.
We noted that also, too, that we have not only the lower tax rates and the fact that we've been asked to do our recomputation for our own returns to see what kind of impact it's liable to have, too. But when you're dealing with not only retirement accounts, too, it gets even more complicated, doesn't it?
Yeah, absolutely, because when you look at the impact on the actual return, that's just more data entry, making sure that there's the withholdings are matching up with the new tax rates, and they didn't adjust them too long to change your refunds. But when you're talking about opportunities, especially with retirement accounts, tax rates are the whole way taxes work in retirement, or what we call the distribution phase, is entirely different. And the sources of those incomes in retirement a lot of times will directly determine whether or not Social Security is reportable. So looking at potential conversions or things of that nature today with lower tax implications can prove beneficial and potentially save a considerable amount in tax implications for the rest of your life.
And I know we've always talked in the past year about the different types of retirement accounts that are available, the IRA, the individual retirement account, and the Roth IRAs. It's also commonly known. And if you make the conversion from one to the other, in particular from an IRA to a Roth, it's even more important that you get things right.
Yeah, absolutely. So contributions are always going to be directed by income. That's why the 401k is still going to be a valuable tool to get contributions in. But when you do a Roth conversion, there's a couple things just to be careful of. On the pure math of it, the simple thing is there's an arbitrage. You're going to be able to convert those dollars today at a cheaper dollar than more likely than will be in the future. And what I mean by that, Chris, is the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is supposed to end in 7 years. I mean, that's what it is. It's a 7-year proposal, and then you're supposed to revert back to the old tax laws. Well, just by simply looking at the tax implications under the old and new, there's a substantial potential savings just because of the tax bracket change. But when you're converting, you do have to pay the taxes, and you have to be cognitive of how much you're converting, you know, whether that's going to force your current brackets into situations that may not prove as beneficial. And they have changed some of the recharacterization rules.
Yeah.
You know, used to be if you converted a Roth and for some reason you wanted to change your mind, you could recharacterize it back to a traditional and basically undo it. And they've gotten rid of that provision now.
Mm-hmm. In fact, you have a deadline, I understand, too, that you have to meet to be able to do it.
Yeah, and the October 17th deadline is for those folks that actually still did it in 2017 when it was still allowed. But any conversions this year basically are permanent.
Now, I wonder, in light of all of this and with the fact that this is only a 7-year law, and just as you've mentioned, as we know, I wonder if Americans will pressure their lawmakers to make sure that there are changes made so that that things will continue on beyond the 7 years instead of ending at that deadline.
Yeah, and a lot of that, I think, is just going to depend directly on how the economy continues to run, how things, you know, impact, because, you know, part of any tax cut is the anticipation of more revenues from, you know, a surging economy because people are spending money. But my concern simply is, you know, these are the lowest tax rates have ever been, and we still have that debt that's out there as a country that eventually needs to be resolved.
Well, I haven't seen a swelling in my paycheck because of it yet, unless it's just too early to tell, I suppose. So.
Yeah, and well, and that's it. It's small dollars. You know, yeah. for most folks, Chris, you're exactly right. You're seeing, you know, a difference of maybe $100, $150 a pay period, depending on how you're paid. It could be smaller if you're weekly. You know, so for a lot of folks, it's not as significant.
One of the other points, too, we want to bring up here in talking about the changes and the impact that, that this new law is going to have on your retirement account is talking about how the estate and the gift taxes, if you are eligible to be affected by them, will be changing. Tell us about that.
So essentially, under the new Tax Cuts and Job Act, it's doubled. The estate and gift tax law has doubled. Under the old law, it was $5.6 million exemption. Under the new law, it's now 11.2. And essentially, in English, Chris, what that basically means is an estate's not going to be subject to what they used to refer to as the estate tax unless there's an estate value over $11.2 million. So for most folks, it basically eliminates any type of implications to pass money on as a legacy to children or other heirs.
We're talking with Northwest Indiana financial advisor Greg Hammer about some of the changes that the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, as the federal reform is known, is going to have on retirement accounting here in your money. And one of the things we often talk about is the impact of charitable deductions and what we should be doing if we want to be sure that we get the right deductions counted on our taxes and the like. And there are some big changes coming in this respect we should know about, too, isn't there?
Yeah, and I think this is probably the one that's going to be more impactful for folks that are making charitable contributions that are in the required minimum distribution phase because of the doubling of the standard deduction. Essentially, it's going to be difficult for most people in retirement just by the natural evolution of retirement. You generally don't have as much mortgage interest. You generally don't have as much state tax you're paying. It's going to be almost impossible for the majority of folks to itemize. Well, with the current laws, charitable donations that are made directly from your IRA accounts to your charitable charity of choice, as long as they're in the RMD part of their distribution, in other words, they're over 70 and a half, those contributions can be deducted. So they don't have to fall under the rules or the aggregation of the item or the standard deduction before they can itemize. You can simply report that on your tax return as what we call a charitable deduction, a QCD, a qualified charitable deduction, and it reduces your tax immediately off the tax return, and you're able to, in essence, deduct the contribution that you make to your organization.
Now, I know that one of the other things that came about is the Reform Act that was passed is that, and you mentioned here about the standard deduction, it's basically doubled now, and that means that fewer taxpayers are going to be able to take advantage of it for medical expenses, I would imagine, too.
Yeah, and the medical expenses, again, you're exactly right, Chris, because the doubling of the exemption is going to, or the standard deduction, I should say, is going to make it more difficult. Medical expenses have reverted back for the 7.5% of the adjusted gross income, but that jumps up now to 10% in 2019. So the only strategy that we could see that may be of value, and this is not always available to a lot of folks, but if you're close to being able to itemize and if you can bunch or group certain medical expenses that are maybe not critical, right? We don't want to delay our health care to try to bunch medical deductions. But a lot of times, you know, being cognizant of the fact that I got to have dental work done or I got to have a procedure done and I'm at the beginning or near the end of a year specifically, you know, is it worth looking at getting it done by the end of the year because I could make, you know, have the opportunity to have that become part of the itemized, or should I push off into the following year where I can bunch it in that year and then create a better tax advantage?
Mm-hmm. I understand that you learned a lot about these changes, the latest from a training workshop that you attended recently about all of this. And tell us what this training workshop was pretty much all about and what some of the other participants besides yourself had a chance to talk about in between sessions over a cup of coffee or maybe later in the day over something a little stronger and how it's going to affect everybody.
Yeah, I mean, I belong to a number of different organizations for ongoing training just to keep up, to date with a lot of the information, that it's constantly changing. And the EdSlot organization has been proactive with IRAs and understanding IRAs and tax planning around IRAs and, you know, what's allowed, what isn't allowed, the specific tax law changes. And so we aggregate as an organization twice a year to, you know, fine-tune our knowledge on recent changes and then interact with other folks about opportunities to work with clients, ideas, thoughts, processes that they feel could be beneficial to the consumer to help produce better results for either, you know, their overall retirement planning or on the tax return or opportunities just in general to save on taxes. Mm.
Are these people that you work with or know of here in Northwest Indiana or the state of Indiana for that matter or Illinois?
It's actually national. It's a national organization. So there's a couple of us here in Northwest Indiana, but it stretches pretty much, I believe they touch just about every state. So we aggregate different areas. This year we were in Philadelphia,
mm-hmm. yeah.
and we just picked different locations across the nation, and everybody comes in and shares ideas, thoughts. It's really it's a great opportunity to work with your peer group and people that are serious about staying up to speed and up to date on their education and how they can provide value to their consumer and to their client.
Now, you get the impression that everybody was a little bit concerned here when the law finally took effect and that they were going to get, besides having to deal with tax returns, that's always the thing that turned out here that came at the wrong time. It could have happened, I suppose, some other time before the time that everybody had to start working with their clients to get their taxes prepared for the year. And it was during a time when the changes in the law didn't take effect yet. So it probably got everybody confused, and it probably had a chance to maybe get a little breather now.
Yeah, and actually now that we know what is in place, because there was still some things that were changed last minute, we're actually, for most of us, are pretty excited about the opportunity because we feel it's going to be, you know, one of the rare opportunities to take advantage. You know, when you do income planning and you have an opportunity to distribute from taxable accounts at a more effective tax rate, it's just understanding how to make that opportunity a reality and understanding the cause and effect in the whole overall income plan. Most of us are very excited about the opportunity we have and the ideas and thoughts to share with our clients.
Well, let's hope that that enthusiasm goes over and affects the clients and makes them feel a little more comfortable about dealing with their funds that they are setting aside for retirement. We appreciate you talking today, Greg.
All right, Chris. Thanks. I enjoyed chatting with you, and thanks for having me on.
That's Northwest Indiana Financial Advisor Greg Hammer. It's time once again for Greenfleet Radio, and here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction, and today our guest is Mr. Ezra Finken. He is the Policy Director for the Diesel Technology Forum. Ezra, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
Ezra, can you tell our listeners, what is the Diesel Technology Forum?
Our group represents the leaders of clean diesel technology, including clean diesel engines, along with the vehicles and equipment they power, affiliated components and fuel producers, including biofuel producers such as biodiesel and renewable diesel fuel. The Diesel Technology Forum serves as an educational nonprofit. We collect and commission research looking at the environmental and economic benefits of clean diesel technology.
You know, the Diesel Technology Forum commissioned some research recently that looked into commercial vehicles on the road in the Midwest. So when it comes to big trucks that move things and do work, can you tell us a little bit more about what's going on in the road in our region?
Sure. Looking at the latest snapshot for commercial vehicles, that includes everything from large work trucks, large pickup trucks, to the biggest Class 8 tractors that power long-haul combination trucks. Diesel is the predominant powertrain under the hood of these vehicles.
Sure.
And of these, Indiana, of all the states in the Midwest, is the top state for the newest trucks.
That's what we like to hear, Ezra.
Yeah. Indiana has consistently ranked number one. 60% of Indiana's commercial vehicle fleet have trucks that come with the latest technology to meet the latest near-zero emission standards set by the EPA.
Mm-hmm.
Nationwide, the national average is about 34%, or works out to about 1 in 3 trucks on the road. This is important because these near-zero emission clean diesel technologies found under the hood of these trucks plays a big role in reducing emissions and improving air quality. So, as I mentioned, Indiana is the number one state in the union for clean diesel trucks, so hats off to Indiana. Illinois and Wisconsin, among the other states in the Midwest, are in the top 10,
mm-hmm.
coming in at number 6 and number 7, respectively. And Ohio isn't too bad at number 16. So the Midwest is certainly a big location for clean diesel trucks.
No, that's wonderful. So I know the Diesel Technology Forum represents clean diesel technology. Can you tell our listeners a little bit more about what clean diesel technology is?
Sure. Clean diesel is real. The term refers to a combination of cleaner fuels, modern diesel engine designs, and after-treatment technologies. These are somewhat similar to a catalytic converter on a gasoline car, that all work in tandem to achieve near-zero emission requirements established for trucks and now larger off-road equipment like construction and ag equipment, and even bigger things like locomotives. These technologies are out in the field and out on the road today, all working to meet the needs of their customers and deliver near-zero emissions.
Sure. On the phone today is Mr. Ezra Finken. He's the policy director for the Diesel Technology Forum. So what are some of the benefits of a clean diesel truck?
Sure. These clean diesel trucks reduce emissions to near-zero levels, as I mentioned earlier, and they provide benefits in terms of clean air that we all breathe, while saving fuel for their owners and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. So, for example, a big clean diesel Class 8 truck can reduce about 2.3 tons of NOx, a smog-forming compound, when you replace that truck with older, is replacing older technology. That works out to the emissions generated from about 2,000 new cars.
Wow.
And these trucks save a lot of fuel as well. That same clean diesel Class 8 truck will save about 960 gallons of fuel for its owner. That translates to about 9.7 tons of greenhouse gas emissions.
Wow, that's wonderful. So I know we also saw an announcement that the Diesel Technology Forum was working with the Environmental Defense Fund, and you teamed up on some research on big engines. Can you tell our listeners about this project and what you found out?
Sure. Much like clean diesel technology developed and deployed on trucks that reduce emissions to near zero levels, the technology is now developed for much, much larger applications like locomotives and marine workboats that include tugs and ferries that I'm sure your listeners are familiar with. Replacing these engines with the latest clean diesel technology is expensive, but result in significant emission reduction. So, for example, repowering tugboat engines that work with clean diesel models works out to the same emissions as removing 96 big tractor trailers or about 26,000 passenger cars. So the emission reductions are substantial. And the research that we commissioned, along with our partner, the Environmental Defense Fund, found that repowering these large, older engines with new clean diesel models is one of the most cost-effective options when it comes to maximizing emission reduction investments. And there are a lot of these older workboats out in the Great Lakes region, we understand, while all the Midwestern states have significant freight rail operations. So the Midwest could certainly benefit from the emission reductions of powering these older engines. And
absolutely,
we know that states will soon have access to the $2.9 billion Environmental Mitigation Trust established in the Volkswagen settlement to achieve these reductions. And these large engine projects, as we call them, will deliver the most emission reductions for the fixed investment provided through the trust.
You know, as you talk about that VW settlement, and again, Indiana is going to be utilizing about $41 million on reducing diesel and NOx emissions here. You know, it's exciting because, you know, working with organizations as yourself, with some of the educational things that you're working on and partnering, you know, with different, you know, facets, of, you know, similar to clean cities. So we're just excited about, you know, some of these benefits that are going to happen. You know, this really is an economic boon for the United States. And I know that you're involved not just in Indiana, but throughout the United States on, you know, these different projects. So we're just, you know, we'd love to have you back on the show just to talk about some of the great projects that were implemented with diesel emissions. So where can our listeners learn more about the Diesel Technology Forum, Ezra?
Please feel free to visit our website, www.dieselforum.org. And we have a wealth of information up there about clean diesel at work in all the states, including Indiana.
Any closing thoughts as we come to the end of our program?
No, I think we've hit all the highlights.
Well, Ezra, you know, again, it's always a pleasure having you on the show, and we look forward to working with you in the near future and having you back to talk about the implementation of some of these great clean diesel initiatives. And that will do it for today's edition of Green Fleet Radio. Thanks again to Mr. Ezra Finken. He's the policy director for the Diesel Technology Forum. And I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks again for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities, and you can hear Green Fleet Radio every Wednesday here on Regionally Speaking, and the podcasts of Green Fleet Radio are also available online on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as our on NPR One on your smartphone. Just search for WLPR. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention recommends that states spend more than $73 million every year on tobacco cessation and prevention efforts. A new report finds, though, that Indiana spends just more than 10% of that amount. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan tells us that is less than half of the national average.
Indiana spent just over $8 million in federal and state dollars in 2016 to help people quit smoking or prevent them from starting. A new analysis from the Richard M. Fairbanks Foundation points to Indiana's high smoking rates, 21% of Hoosiers. President and CEO Claire Fidian Green says that impacts everyone.
We can't forget the economic burden that all of us, even the 79% of us who don't smoke, bear through higher taxes for Medicaid and other health care costs.
An estimated 11,000 Hoosiers die each year from tobacco-related illnesses. The report recommends the state spend more than $65 million more a year to help people quit and prevent young people from starting. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Indiana Chief Justice Loretta Rush says that judicial leaders from across the country feel a sense of urgency as they develop an infrastructure for court systems to be able to address the nation's opioid crisis. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Brandon Smith reports on an Indianapolis meeting of a national judicial task force that was formed last year.
Chief Justice Loretta Rush is the co-chair of the National Judicial Opioid Task Force. She says the group develops solutions for court systems to address the country's drug epidemic, urging states to enter into border agreements.
We have a child in Indiana who gets removed and placed in foster care. We can't get that child placed across in Illinois. Why? Because there's this archaic law that says it takes 6, 9, 12 months, and maybe you get approved, maybe you don't.
But Rush says the bulk of the solutions will come from individual communities, and the task force can help empower those communities.
That takes sort of the melding of grants and resources and education together.
Rush says a big job of the task force is getting other stakeholders to recognize courts can play a role to help solve the drug crisis. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Brandon Smith at the State House.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. We now have two conversations for you on the opioid crisis that affects Northwest Indiana and the rest of the Hoosier State. Lake County Coroner Marilee Fry recently spoke at a regular meeting with some community group and gave an update at the same time about the opioid crisis. In fact, and she had some very sad and shocking statistics to give as well.
Our numbers have definitely been increasing in regards to our opioid-related deaths. In 2017 alone, we've had 196 overdose deaths, and close to half of those were opioid-related. As a matter of fact, 62 of them were fentanyl, and 44 of them were heroin. And we are also seeing an increase in those that overdose from carfentanil. We're just seeing an emergence of that in the last 2 years.
I know you mentioned to the folks here at the meeting that it seems that the opioid addiction numbers are going to be climbing exponentially, almost, I guess, in the years ahead before they start to fade down or even trail off any, isn't it?
Yes, the CDC and the DEA has projected over the course of the next few years that those numbers are going to skyrocket, and they're going to take off like a jet airplane before we see those numbers coming down.
You mentioned about the fact that people have ways of being able to know, or at least tell, at least that there's a problem out there with a family member, a loved one, or someone else here. Tell us about what you've mentioned to the folks here in the meeting, the things they should or others should watch for to try and find some signs or maybe some addiction problem someplace.
Well, I do know it's important for our youth as parents to make sure that we know who their friends are, where they're going, and that they're engaging in healthy activities. Some of the things that you can look for are a change in their moods or their behaviors. It's important to monitor their grades to see academically how are they doing, are they continuing to achieve the same achievements that they've previously achieved, as well as monitoring their bedrooms to see, looking in between mattresses and drawers, checking their cell phones, knowing who their friends are, keeping your eyes out and being aware to see if you notice any changes in your child.
Have you talked with people, not necessarily related to being a coroner, but just being a nurse, and people that you know that have had opportunities to use some of this advice and in turn have been able to stave off the potential for somebody passing away because of a drug overdose?
Yeah, absolutely. I've talked with our emergency room nurses and physicians. I've been attending events at school. For example, this week in Hammond, I attended Hammond Technical School. I spoke with their students that are in the medical careers class in regards to the opioid epidemic and the work that we do within the coroner's office. They asked a lot of great questions. So I do think that being coroner allows me an opportunity to educate our community, to speak with those that have certainly been able to make a positive difference based on what we are hearing and seeing. And they have reported back to me that often I have met with people that have a loved one that has an addiction, and we've been able to get them to a treatment provider. But certainly it can make a difference. Not that I want to say it can be a scare tactic, but it is startling and alarming to hear of how dangerous substance use can be, and also certainly in regards to our opioid epidemic, how dangerous heroin and carfentanil are.
I know you were asked questions by many people here at the meeting, and one question was asking here why we seem to see the increase in the trend now. And you mentioned some interesting facts, I think, some historical problems that kind of had led over time to why we see the opioid epidemic right now. Tell us about those, please.
Well, I believe in the 1970s that there was heroin out, from what I understood. I was a child at the time, but I do know in the 70s that heroin was out there, but it was very expensive. And at this time, heroin is very inexpensive, and it's more accessible than it has been. And there's a couple of ways that somebody could become addicted to an opioid. Often we know that our gateway drugs are marijuana and alcohol, and if our young people use them, it certainly can put them in a compromised position where if they had peer pressure and they offered them an opportunity to use a substance like heroin, they just might make that poor decision if they were under the influence of something else. So I think nobody, you know, starts out by wanting to have an addiction. As a matter of fact, I believe everybody thinks that it couldn't happen to them. Another way could be, besides peer pressure or starting out with some gateway drugs, could be that somebody may have an incident, a post-operative pain management put in place by their physician, or possibly they could have had some type of injury, sports-related or motor vehicle accident, a back injury, where a physician would prescribe an opioid such as Vicodin or oxycodone. And within a short period of time, that it is possible, especially for someone that may be predisposed to an addiction, it's possible that they could develop an addiction. It's possible it could be very difficult for them to come off of the medication. And once the physician no longer prescribes, they could look to other people. And then eventually, and that's quite costly to get those prescription medications on the street, eventually they may look to something inexpensive such as heroin so they can continue to get that opioid. And I can say that these are substances that are no longer pharmaceutically controlled. You don't know if you're getting a certain milligram dose as if a pharmacist had made the or a pharmaceutical company had made the drug. You are now getting something that a drug dealer on the street has prepared, and it could be the fatal dose.
Well, you mentioned, too, about the fact that maybe with some of these drugs now that we're seeing with the fentanyl, the carfentanil in particular, the stronger, more dangerous kinds of opiates that are getting mixed in with these drugs, and it makes things even more dangerous now.
Yes, absolutely. And I think the reason for that is these drug dealers want to get them addicted quicker. They think they're going to buy heroin, and they have no knowledge of it. They're actually getting something laced with that fentanyl or the carfentanil. It's going to give them an increased type of feeling or high, and certainly it's going to make them want to come back that much sooner to buy more.
I know you mentioned to the audience here about the importance of finding ways to not get hooked to begin with, so to speak, let the addiction take hold. And you talked about the ways that a person who may have to have gone in for surgery or some medical procedure, which in turn resulted in pain, and they may need some help. And you talked about finding alternatives to these very addictive and very dangerous, but very, unfortunately, very effective painkillers.
Yes, so that certainly is possible after somebody has had surgery and they're on post-operative pain management. We do know that that's not a chronic pain. That's what we call acute pain, and that prescription medication certainly can be effective in managing that pain. But we do know that there are prescriptions available that are non-opioid related, such as Toradol. That can be very effective for, let's say, orthopedic procedures and some other type of procedures. And that's a medication that you can't take for a long period of time for chronic pain medication or for chronic treatment such as cancer, but it can be very effective. And Toradol is a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, so it works similar to ibuprofen. So certainly I think it's good that if somebody does need pain management, for them to talk to their physician and ask, are there any other options? Is there any other medication available that could be non-opioid related?
I know since you work very closely with law enforcement agencies and with the sheriff's department and the county jail on these issues in particular, you mentioned about the fact that there seem to be so many people who are either have gone into incarceration or they're coming out of being incarcerated, and maybe they may have had problems before because they were locked up. They didn't get the drugs. They may have been weaned off to a point, but they'll go right back on if they're not careful. What methods or techniques are you finding are ways to deal with that?
Well, we do know that those that are incarcerated are our most vulnerable population. And with that, we recently did some research. I've been working with a new position in my office called a drug overdose analysis, and we've been looking at numbers and comparing numbers of those that have lost their life and have been coroner's cases and comparing them with those that have been incarcerated in the Lake County Jail. And just in recent weeks, we have learned that a large percentage of those that are incarcerated at the Lake County Jail that have an opioid addiction and that are released within that first year of being released, that it is very likely that they can lose their life due to a drug overdose.
What do you find that seems to help in trying to, if not to stop it altogether, but at least to be able to postpone it?
Well, I did go to our Lake County Council, and I've asked them to accept or adopt a resolution, and the resolution is a program called the Prescription for Action Program. Mm-hmm. I did a little bit of research, and I found out on the East Coast that their community leaders have put together this program called the Prescription for Action Plan, and it's a program that engages community leaders in addressing our opioid epidemic. It outlines a very good strategic plan, and one of them is addressing those that are incarcerated. So with that, we have been having monthly meetings with the Lake County Sheriff, and we've looked at how can we help those that have an opioid addiction, and are they ready for treatment? So we have identified those that have an opioid addiction. We have implemented a plan to test them with therapists to identify if they're really ready and serious to enter a treatment program, and if they are soon in the very near future going to be offered a medication for an opioid addiction called Vivitrol that can be injected and that will be effective for 28 days that will block the receptor allowing an opioid to come into that barrier. In other words, if they were to use an opioid, if they have an opioid addiction, it would cancel it out, kind of like it would become canceled out and they would not be able to achieve a high, so therefore they likely would not look to that. Also, it would be an important part of their opportunity to go before the prosecuting attorney and the judge to offer it as a condition of their plea bargaining. For example, if somebody has committed a crime and they have an opioid addiction, they could possibly, you know, plead to their situation, and an important part of that plea bargaining would include that they would go through the Vivitrol program in the jail, and then once they're released, they would be on probation. They would be connected immediately with a treatment provider, and it would be monitored to make sure that they are having follow-up appointments, that they're having drug tests, and that they're remaining clean, and that they're continuing to get that Vivitrol injection every 28 days.
Finally, Mary Lee, I know it's not able to be able to stop all of the overdose deaths, but in the experience that you have and the courses and the workshops you've had a chance to participate in, and talking with people as well too, and maybe with family members, what, I guess, advice or what can you prescribe, so to speak, to family members, to what they should be watching for if they have family members that are having problems or have the potential of having problems that could unfortunately lead to being just another member of the opioid statistics?
Well, certainly you would see a change in their behavior. And also, sadly, you may see that they're making choices that are not good choices, such as stealing from family members. You'll not only notice that change in their behavior, whether it be nodding off or not showing up for work or that money is missing, that they're not being responsible or accountable with any finances that they have, and that they're interrupting family finances by taking from other people. So those are some of the things that you could look for. And if you notice that, it would be best to encourage them to go talk with somebody in a treatment program. Sometimes the mindset of going into a treatment program might be too much, but if you can ask them to be willing to talk with somebody, just simply make that one step. If they're willing to say, I have a problem, admit they have a problem, and admit that they would be willing to talk to somebody. Here in Lake County, we have many great treatment programs. We have regional mental health. We have Recovery Works. We have Heartland Recovery. So we have a many, many great treatment programs throughout Lake County, and they're willing to help them, and whether it be an inpatient or an outpatient program, but certainly encourage them to talk with somebody.
Mary Lee Fry, thanks very much.
Thank you.
As Northwest Indiana, and all of Indiana for that matter, deals with the opioid addiction epidemic that we are facing, there are organizations out there creating resource centers to help Hoosiers who are struggling with substance abuse disorder for themselves as well as for their loved ones. One of them is called the Addiction Policy Forum. And we have with us one of the key people involved in this project. Justin Phillips is the founder and the executive director of an organization in Indianapolis called Overdose Lifeline Incorporated, and she's joining us from the capital city. Justin, thanks for joining us here on Regionally Speaking.
Thank you for having me.
If you will, explain first what the organization that you founded, of which you're the executive director, Overdose Lifeline, is all about.
In my previous life, I was working to address unintentional injuries and deaths that were primarily due to motor vehicle crashes, falls, fire and burn. And so I understood public health and policy and grassroots advocacy around preventable death, but I did not expect to have a life experience of losing my son to a heroin overdose. So his name was Aaron, and he passed away in October of 2013. And at that time, Indianapolis Metropolitan Police were just beginning to look at using the overdose reversal drug naloxone. Mm-hmm. So the law had just passed for first responders. And I like to call it sometimes the imperfect storm that I have this professional skill set and this very difficult life experience. And I was exposed to a need that existed, which was to help first responders have access to the overdose reversal drug, and also to address all the other gaps in understanding, knowledge, and prevention around opioid misuse. So that's what we do.
It's a very, very simple mode of a way to get to help out to people that need the help the most, certainly. What have you found in the years since you founded the nonprofit about trying to deal in particular with such a serious crisis as not only the opioid epidemic, but also just, I guess, for that matter, the stigma of addiction itself?
Right. That's like really the key piece is the stigma that exists and the shame that individuals who are suffering from opioid use disorder have, the judgment we have on society around this particular chronic disease, the way that we treat it, completely different than other chronic diseases, and the complete lack of understanding that we all had, including myself, that prescription for a legitimate reason, like hydrocodone, is in fact heroin in a different form.
Right. Yeah. We understand that the Addiction Policy Forum is really a nationwide organization, of which I know that you're the Indiana State Chapter co-chair. How did you get involved directly with the APF, as it's called? Is it certainly from the work that you have done every single day, working for the Overdose Lifeline?
You know, I would hope that because we have this active role in our state, that they considered us already a leader, and we did get an introduction to them early on a few months ago when they were beginning their work. So they did come to us and ask, you know, myself and Overdose Lifeline to serve as state co-chair.
In putting things together for the presentation to be able to get this word out about the creation of the Indiana chapter, what statistics can you share with us here about the problem as it happened, the last information you have from 2016, and how many people in Indiana seem to be affected by the epidemic?
It's so challenging to know completely, but I would venture to guess when we consider that whole 6 degrees of separation concept, that every single person knows someone, that every single person is affected within that 6 degrees of separation.
Now, in your experience with the overdoses in the handling the cases that you have handled here, we know, of course, there are different types of overdoses. In particular, we have, of course, the serious narcotics. We I guess, more or less associate with overdose problems like heroin and other things, cocaine as well. But where does the opioids seem to fit into this now that everything seems to be changing? At the emphasis now seems to be moving a little away from those older narcotics, so to speak, and with this new one, the opioids.
We know that, so they're all opioids, right? And we also know that 4 out of 5 people start with a prescription and move to heroin. And often individuals are moving to heroin because they found themselves addicted to their opioid prescription and no longer able to acquire it. So we, for one cause, is that we overprescribed. We made pain a vital sign, and we overprescribed. And the last statistic I heard from the CDC director was we had enough medication for every single American citizen to be medicated every day for 3 weeks.
Good okay? grief.
So we had too many prescriptions. And then, say, I myself found myself dependent on my prescription, but my doctor won't give it to me anymore because he's caught on to me misusing. And so I turn to the street because I'm unwilling to suffer through the withdrawal, and I don't have any resources to help me with the withdrawal, which is typical. So I go to the street, and you'd be surprised who's buying drugs off the street, okay? And you'd be surprised who's selling drugs. We have elderly patients prescribed narcotics who are selling their prescriptions for money. But anyway, you know, on the street, a prescription pill is $80, but the drug dealer says to you, hey, I have this similar thing you've been using, and they don't tell you it's heroin, and you get it, and they say just snort it, and you snort it, and now you're doing heroin, and now you're hooked on heroin.
No. The Addiction Policy Forum has created an addiction resource center that is helping Hoosiers dealing with this problem of substance abuse disorder. If you will, take us through the process, starting with the toll-free number that's available for people, family members, or addicts, people realizing that they're addicted to the drugs, that they can call, and what procedure do they go through, what help will they get on the other end of the line?
So you can use their toll-free number Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. to 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And when you call that number, you will be connected to an individual who is trained in addiction navigation. So it may be a clinical person. It may be a person trained in peer recovery processes. But that live person will help you navigate what type of treatment you may need, what type of treatment you may be looking for, what your insurance coverage is, who's taking insurance, who's not, do you need inpatient, do you need outpatient, you know, all the various facets of what somebody might need. That person on the other end of the phone is going to be able to provide help with you to answer those questions.
We're talking,
and
with...
they're going to know the questions you need to ask, right? Because some families and caregivers don't even know what to ask.
We're talking with Justin Phillips, who is the creator and executive director of an organization in Indianapolis called Overdose Lifeline, which is a nonprofit that helps serve the state of Indiana and is dedicated to preventing opioid deaths and reducing the stigma of addiction. And we're talking about her being the co-chair of the Indiana State chapter of what is called the Addiction Policy Forum. We've talked a little bit here about this toll-free number that people can call to reach the Addiction Resource Center. And we know so many people are connected or interconnected by the Internet these days. Is there an online resource center that if people go online, they can take advantage of too in the same way as making the phone call?
The Addiction Resource Center is an online portal that you can actually use if you are concerned about yourself or you're concerned about someone else. So you would make that choice when you're on the portal. And then again, you can choose, you can take an assessment, or if you already know and you don't need to take an assessment, you can do what they call build your own action plan, and you can choose all these fields and do all these filters. So it will then provide to you the resources within your community that are available to you at this time.
Now, we know that the Addiction Policy Forum and the Addiction Resource Center that it's created here in Indiana is relatively new, but have you had a chance to find out from the folks working at the center, are there any success stories yet that somebody has called the hotline or they've reached it online to find out more information to get the help they needed and been able to save somebody's life?
I think it's too new for us to have any of those anecdotal stories back yet. I apologize.
Yeah. Well, that's what we learn about these things, and that's why I guess over time you get the information in. It's sad enough that the opioid addiction epidemic has gone on as long as it had. Is there anything, one thing in particular, as we conclude our conversation here, that you would like to pass along to our listeners about the advantages of this particular service, that why it's so important to go online or to make the phone call?
I think it's important for families especially to know that there is someone out there who can help them with the overwhelming misunderstanding and questions and concerns that they have. It's a very lonely place to be when you have somebody that you love suffering from substance use disorder, and the shame and stigma interfere with your really willingness to want to talk to the people closest to you, you know, coworkers. I would say we never bring casseroles to people who have substance use disorder, but we always bring casseroles to people who, you know, have someone in their family suffering from cancer.
We're talking with Justin Phillips, who is the wife and mother of three children, and sad to say one of their sons passed away from a heroin overdose in 2014, and that's led to her involvement as the founder and the executive director of an organization in Indianapolis called Overdose Lifeline. And she is also now the co-chair for the Indiana chapter, the Addiction Policy Forum. And they have just created an addiction resource center to help people that are suffering and family members, too, that are suffering as well through the opioid epidemic. And Justin, thank you very much for being with us to tell us, unfortunately, the sad story that you face personally, but the way that you're able to help other people get out of the problems that they are in.
Well, thank you for the opportunity to share the resource and to help eliminate the need that individual families and caregivers have.
Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie is joining us in the studio to answer your pet's questions in our recent Wednesday segment called Ask Ollie. And the pet questions are voiced by a man-human Tom Maloney, and the responses from Ollie are voiced by his woman-human handler, Victoria Voller. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. And we offer today this advisory. There is a term that's used in the conversation to describe a female dog that's used to breed litters.
Dear Ollie, I hope you can fix this problem. There's a new 6-week-old, 2-pound, 7-ounce Shih Tzu puppy in our community, and I'm very worried. The little guy was bought from a greeter operating out of a local puppy mill in Center Township. And that's a real concern for me. Why? Because those puppy mills operate in the community, and those greeters, that's spelled G-R-E-E-D-E-R-S, as I call them, want their puppies sold young, small, and early. Many work off of disposable cell phones and collect cash only. The pups are bred from a bitch that spends her days in small, filthy cages, churning out litter after litter of puppies to be sold for profit. Her dull, patchy coat is painfully matted, and her ears are full of biting mites. Her nails have grown so long that they curl under and pierce her tender paws. She's surrounded by hundreds of other dogs, also caged and in poor health, and their chaotic, panicked barking is deafening and relentless. No one ever tells her that she's a good girl or gives her a treat. No one scratches behind her ears or kisses the top of her head. I know. My woman human has raised many litters of puppies from the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana and for Lakeshore Paws. She said it's an old wives' tale that a six-week-old puppy is ready for adoption. She observed that pups learn important behaviors from their moms and litter mates, interpreting dominance, inhibiting biting behaviors, and submission to a dominant dog. He learns what it's like to play and romp and behave correctly among his pack of siblings and his mom. Simply speaking, a six-week-old puppy hasn't been in our world long enough to learn the correct behaviors from his mom and siblings, she says. In other words, between 5 and 8 weeks, a pup is still learning how to be a dog. How do I know? Because I was lucky enough to have been rescued from a puppy mill in southern Indiana last year, and I live in a great home now. Signed, Bella, a Maltese dog residing in Crown Point.
Dear Bella, well, who doesn't want a darling itty-bitty ball of fur? The puppy mill greeters bank, and I use that word for a reason, on the fact that we're all suckered in by a tiny little fur face. With toy breeds, the petite and or teacup size sells well for them. This tiny ball of fur is irresistible, and you've heard it said that he'll bond with your family the younger he is. Oh no, think again. The age you bring your puppy home can make the difference between a well-adjusted pet and one who is neurotic, frightened, and having behavior problems for the rest of his life. And what about the health issues a tiny one will face? Missy Boss, a vet tech for 23 years at the Munster Animal Clinic, said, "I wish common sense was more common. At 6 weeks, a puppy needs its first round of vaccines. Without these prophylactic treatments, they run the risk for catching parvo, distemper, kennel cough, and other very unpleasant diseases." Reputable dog breeders are concerned about a dog's composition, health, and disposition. A greeter, as you call them, is money hungry and only concerned with the composition and health of his or her wallet. Responsible shelters and breeders will not allow their puppies to leave their moms until after 8 weeks and will encourage a potential puppy owner to see the pup's mother and father while visiting every square inch of their facility. Puppy mills keep you away from their operation, and for a good reason. Often they'll bring the pup to you in a neutral location. When shopping for a puppy, don't support puppy mills by acquiring your fur baby in a pet store, meeting someone in a van, or by a shopping center, or answering a blind ad. If a puppy looks too young to go home with you, the baby probably is. An 8 or 9 week old pup is ideal. Adopt, don't shop, and consider a local reputable shelter. If your heart is set on a purebred, then seek out a breeder who has references and a great local reputation. Ollie, your friend in fur. And by the way, I am worried about that six-week-old Shih Tzu.
You can send your pet-related questions to Ollie at lakeshorepublicmedia.org. Tomorrow on Regionally Speaking, it's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, which means we'll have from The Times, Carmen McCollum and Doug Ross, and we'll have Meredith Collius-Pete and Carol Carlson from The Post-Tribune. Hope you can join us.